This morning, we have the privilege of listening to Brother Larry McClellan. He has served us well for many years. We always appreciate his thoughts. And he has the privilege and distinction of giving us the first talk for 2006. And he has chosen as his subject, Marriage, a Checkup from the Neck Up. Marriage, a Checkup from the Neck Up. Brother Larry.
Thank you, Brother Irwin. It's a wonderful privilege to be here with all of you at the convention today. We bring you the warm Christian love and greetings of your brethren in Columbus, Indiana. I'm happy to have my wife, Sister Debbie, here with me today, as well as my dear mother. I think she's out there somewhere. And we certainly appreciate the loving hospitality of Brother Joe and Sister Kathy Migaz and all they've done for us. I think most of you would agree the marriage institution that God has designed has been under considerable attack in the past 40 years. Would you not agree with that? To my understanding, 6 out of 10 marriages in the country fail to go full term, till death do us part. Even countries like Japan are also finding the same effects of our Western civilization taking their toll on their marriages. Stresses from this fast-paced time of trouble that we live in, along with attitudes and society's moral decline, popularly shaped by Hollywood movies and television, have accelerated the damage done in this pivotal core of a healthy community composition. We live in a throwaway society, a throwaway attitude in our culture where if you don't need it anymore or it's not useful to you, just throw it away and get something else to take its place. Many young couples today find that living together is a better alternative than the marriage statistics on divorce. But live-in marriages encourage the idea of marriage not being a lifelong commitment. And to my understanding, those who engage in such cohabitation usually don't make a marriage that works. And scripturally speaking, it's just plain wrong. Gay couples are marrying, some wanting to adopt children. I think it's 1 out of 4 children in our country do not live with 2 married couples or 2 married parents. Alternative and extended families are becoming more and more common. I think, and perhaps you would agree, that marriages and marriage relationships are challenged like never before. For those who have lived long enough to compare, I think you'd agree that the marriage institution has been under considerable attack. Perhaps you would also agree that Bible student marriages are not exempt. This is the reason for this discourse. Brother Russell made a very profound statement when he said one time, whatever is prevalent in the world will be a special threat to the church. And I think that has proven true over time. I also think that the prevailing attitudes about marriage and the marriage institution in our society are slowly but surely creeping into the mental paradigm of the present new creation. But today's discussion will be focused primarily in some of these 4 areas. Number 1, the Christian and marriage ideal. 2, issues in marriages and what we call the love bank. Thirdly, marriage maintenance and some, perhaps setting some goals for marriage improvement, maybe to start out the new year. And then last, we'll probably only have a little time, we'll talk about divorce. Now I have a few disclaimers that I'd like to give you before we begin. First, I am not a marriage counselor by profession. I don't have any real training. I just have about 35 years of practical experience and observations in my marriage, as well as other people's marriages. This doesn't make me necessarily equipped to counsel brethren in their marriages. In fact, I prefer not to, unless you're desperate. Second, I can almost guarantee that most of you will not agree with me on entirely everything I speak about today. Remember, I have two pockets, as my brother Laddie Stewart often says, a fact pocket and an opinion pocket. And marriage, you know, is a multi-dimensional subject, quite complex in nature, as I'm sure we'd all agree. And we only have, maybe 50 minutes to discuss it. Now, you surely wouldn't expect me to hit every base in that amount of time, and I won't be doing that. We're going to just skip rocks off the surface of the pond, so to speak, but much will go unsaid. There are many areas of marriage that we will not cover, as well as things about separation and divorce that we won't mention as well. Third, please don't read between the lines too much about Brother Larry and Sister Debbie's marriage. I will often be speaking about other couples' marriages as I observe them as well. Also, don't assume I'm speaking about anybody in particular that you know of, because I'm not. These are issues and principles and suggestions in marriage that could apply to many different couples. This talk is going to be a little bit different. I mean, normally we expect to have doctrinal presentations on justification or, you know, on sanctification or on the thousand years or on, you know, Israel or something like that. This one's going to be a little bit different. But, brethren, I think in this day and age, I think it's important to give talks on marriage like this once in a while. I think we need it. And so we hope by the Lord's grace we're able to give one that's helpful today. Now, we'd like to make some rules up before we get into this. It's always good to have some rules that we'd like you to follow while we're giving this discourse, especially the last half. First, no patting your spouse on the knee when I make any statement that you feel applies to your spouse, okay? This would be quite embarrassing. Likewise, no elbowing or long stares at the eyes of your spouse during any portion of this discourse. Think less. Think less about how your spouse should be listening well to these words, and more about how you personally can be making improvements in your marriage. Next, you might try to write down at least one or two goals for improvement that you really could commit yourself to in the months and years ahead. And I know that not all of us here are married, and we have some dear souls in the audience that, you know, are widows and widowers as well. So it doesn't apply to you in the immediate sense, but you can perhaps reflect on things in your own marriages along these lines. And we have many young people here that may be considering marriage someday, so hopefully it would apply and we'd have some food for thought for you as well. The last rule is that silent prayers are always in order. If there's anything that you find in self-awareness or personal infractions in your marriage relationship, you can be instant in prayer and ask the Lord for His promised strength to change as well as to bear all things. Now let's move on and do a quick overview of the ideal for a new creature in Christ. We all have a great deal of respect for the Apostle Paul, who wrote so many of the chapters and books in the New Testament. The Apostle Paul gave his opinion on this issue in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 7, where he states, as far as the ideal for the new creature, he says, "Not by commandment, but by permission, having the Spirit of God, that basically a person can better serve the interest of the Lord and their consecrations if they remain unmarried, like he was." Let's just read verse 6. "But I speak this by permission and not of commandment, for I would that all men were even as myself, but every man hath his proper gift of God, one after this manner and another after that. Verse 8. This is 1 Corinthians 7:8. I say therefore to the unmarried and widows, it is good for them if they abide even as I. But if they cannot contain, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn. Now later on the Apostle Paul goes on to say in verse 24 of chapter 7, brethren, let every man wherein he is called, therein abide with God. Verse 25, now concerning virgins, I have no commandment of the Lord, yet I give my judgment as one that hath obtained mercy of the Lord to be faithful. I suppose, therefore, that this is good for the present distress, I say, that it is good for a man so to be. Art thou bound unto a wife? Seek not to be loosed. Art thou loosed from a wife? Seek not a wife. But and if thou marry, thou hast not sinned. And if a virgin marry, she hath not sinned. Nevertheless, such shall have trouble in the flesh. But I spare you. And later, he says in verse 32, But I would have you without carefulness. He that is unmarried careth for the things that belongeth to the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But he that is married careth for the things that are of the world, how he may please his wife. There is difference also between a wife and a virgin. The unmarried woman careth for the things of the Lord, that she might be holy both in body and in spirit. But she that is married careth for the things of the world, how she may please her husband. And this I speak for your own profit, not that I may cast a snare upon you, but for that which is comely, and that ye may attend upon the Lord without distraction. And finally, Paul concludes with this in verses 38 through 40, where he says, so then, he that giveth her in marriage doeth well, but he that giveth her not in marriage doeth better. The wife is bound by the law so long as her husband liveth, but if her husband be dead, she is at liberty to be married to whom she will, only in the Lord. But she is happier if she so abide, after my judgment, and I think also that I have the Spirit of God. So there's the absolute highest ideal condition for the Christian, the way I see it, or the way I read it. Now let's say that somebody determines that they should like to go ahead and get married anyway. Of course, many of us have here in this building, in this room. That they have good reasons and have found a great match. What's the next best position? Well, Paul said it, didn't he? She is at liberty to be married only in the Lord. I believe that our beloved Apostle Paul was still giving advice here, but it was sound advice. So, if you're bound and determined to get married, you'd be better off spiritually to find someone who is also of the same mind, a consecrated mind. In the sixth volume, Brother Russell discusses this on pages 514 to 516 and basically shares his thoughts that worldly people ought to marry worldly people, church-going believers should marry church-going believers, and the consecrated ought to marry the consecrated. Why? Because a marriage usually works more smoothly when two people have the same mind about things, the same loves, the same ambitions and the same goals, the same standards of living, and so on. Does it work out sometimes despite an unequally yoked marriage? Yes. We have seen some lovely marriages where the couple respects each other and supports each other, and sometimes the unbelieving spouse eventually even consecrates themselves to the Lord. This can happen. Should you count on it? I believe you could pray for that to happen, but I wouldn't count on it. Disappointment often comes from unfulfilled expectations, sometimes worse. I believe there are no guarantees in marriage. You could also have a marriage of two consecrated people that have a dysfunctional marriage. It's possible. But what I believe the apostle and the pastor is suggesting here is there is a good, better, and best situation where your best probability for a successful marriage relationship, where you can serve the Lord, grow spiritually, go to meetings, and so forth, are when you marry only in the Lord. Marriage becomes a first mortgage on our time. The question is, in what situation will you most likely have the most time to give to the Lord? being equally or unequally yoked. And we repeat once again, we have seen several unequally yoked marriages in our lifetime where the spouse is very supportive and respects the religion and spiritual needs of his spouse. But this is usually an exceptional situation, in my opinion. When most people get married in their youth today, usually physical attractiveness and sexuality play a huge part in their selection. However, not only the previous comments should be considered, but other considerations like this might be taken into account. Number one, common goals and aims in life. Two, will we have children or not? Three, personal feelings and reactions on different issues. Four, standards of life to live by. Five, common likes and dislikes. And honesty is essential in any lasting relationship. When a man and woman marry, they create a new being, a dual being, composed of two ever-changing individuals. Genesis 2:24 states God's intention for this union. He states there, as you're all familiar, "Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall become one flesh." There's a commitment to becoming one, a mental and emotional merging of two souls, two hearts beating as one. How long is this commitment? Until death do us part. It's a commitment of patient perseverance, to stick it out to the end, not give up, but make it work. If not for each other, make it work for the Lord as much as is possibly within you. We look out at this group of Christian marriages here, and we see many fine examples of two people that have waded through the rough waters of life and stormed the seas together when things were pretty rough, but they stuck it out. There may have been some water leaking in at times, but they worked it out together and handed each other a can to scoop out the water from the ship of their marriage so it wouldn't sink. And there was probably some emotion and strong feelings in the process, wouldn't you imagine? But you know what kept them together, besides their strong love for each other? It was the super glue of the truth that bonded many of them so very tightly, and good friends in the truth that gave them support when they needed it. In Ephesians 5, once again, the Apostle Paul is there to give us some more insight to how a marriage should be. Let's read a few verses. Ephesians 5, 25. And we'll probably read this again before the end of the talk for another purpose. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with a washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife even as himself, and the wife see that she reverence her husband. So what is Paul saying here in a nutshell? Isn't he saying that we need to look at our marriages as the opportunity to show the Lord, Christ, and the church's relationship in this picture in our homes? Does Brother Larry do his personal best to treat his wife with the same loving devotion that Christ would give to his church? Does Sister Debbie do her personal best to treat her husband with the same loving devotion that the church would show unto Christ? In fact, We could reword this perhaps like in 1 Corinthians 10:31, where Paul states, "Whether therefore ye eat or drink or whatsoever you do, do all to the glory of God." To reword it like this, whether you eat or drink or get married, or how you live in your marriage, do all to the glory of God. So the ideal to strive for in a marriage, the way I see it, is to make every effort to glorify God in your marriages. We must find ways that we can glorify God in our marriage, in the way we say things, in the way we do things, even in the way that we think about things and each other. The question should be, how am I glorifying God in my marriage? So thus far, the ideal marriage in the Lord is where two people are consecrated and committed to each other with a strong bond of love and reverential respect for each other that God has directed in the Scriptures. It's a pledge of lasting commitment and oftentimes patient endurance while you iron out the wrinkles of life. Now let's talk about some of those wrinkles. What are some of the issues that face marriages today? Even among the Bible student marriages, there may be different levels of consecration to the Lord. One spouse may be more fervent in the Spirit or desires to sacrifice more to the Lord of their time and of their energy. One may read truth literature and pray a lot more, although that isn't always an exact indicator of a close relationship with the Lord. The one spouse can't belittle the other in any way, but rather lead by example and positive reflections on the blessings of their readings and their services. Within any Bible student marriage, there are some great stresses that come on marriages from raising children. We all know that who have raised them. Friction over different issues requires lots of the lubrication of love and understanding to overcome those obstacles. Again, it's a lot easier when you're not trying to take the children to two different churches and raising the children with a different rule book than the other spouse. Sometimes there are issues bearing down on couples with unrelenting workloads in today's busy marketplace. Time management is something we can all work on, I'm sure. But time is like a vice that twists people into sometimes saying things out of frustration that it doesn't always come out the way they meant it. Communication skills are essentially important. Oftentimes under stress or just everyday household functions, words can best be received when they come from or with, you might say, the attachment, as we do with our computers. Darling, do you think you could clean up that mess on the floor? Or, honey, would it be possible to get some help with those dishes? Oftentimes in our marriages, we, Sister Debbie and I, do that. We try to preface things with honey or darling, and it makes the other part a little easier. Playing fair is important in any sport, where you have two teams respecting each other. It is no different in the marriage. The husband must and the wife must both play fair. They must strive to be fair in conducting all the combined activities of the team's workload. They must be fair in discussions over issues that arise to make sure that they are choosing their words fairly and accurately as possible, as well as giving the other party a fair time to speak their mind on the issue as well. What are your thoughts on that, sweetheart? In my opinion, listening skills seem to be standard equipment on the female gender. Many of us brothers, especially me, could work a lot better at being a better listener. Sometimes sisters are not looking for the solution to their problem. They're just looking for you to listen to them share some thoughts and feelings. When it comes to planning, the veteran couple who have a lot of years under their belt generally are good at planning together. Often a young marriage seems to have my plans versus your plans, when our plans should be stamped on the package for a better delivery. Now let's stop here for a moment and recognize that we are not all blessed with a perfect marriage. In fact, there are probably not a lot of couples out there who would claim to have a perfect marriage, and we're not one of them. That would be nice and solve a lot of problems, wouldn't it, for many of us? So we must come to grip with the facts. Number one, we are all of us, more or less stained with the Adamic fall. And most of us have plenty of weaknesses to overcome. I know I do. Since we're not perfect, and since we want to play fair, then should we really be expecting perfection from our spouse? Is that really fair? High standards and perfection are two different things. Don't expect your spouse to be perfect unless you are. Wouldn't our marriages be working more smoothly if we continually worked at being more teachable, more humble, more receptive to learning from one another, clothed with humility, as the Scriptures implore us to be? If we stretched our patience a little further where we thought the Lord would be pleased? Now, there are some big issues that threaten marriages today. And in a counseling marriage article that I was reading, it had a lot of good suggestions on marriage issues. These big problems were not necessarily big, but they were common problems in marriage counseling. These were called love busters. I kind of like that. Love busters are things that could eat away at a marriage relationship if couples are not more careful. Some of these main love busters were: one, lack of empathy for their spouse. See if you agree with some of these. Two, making selfish demands. Three, making disrespectful judgments. Four, angry outbursts. Five, annoying habits. And six, they had honesty on there, but I don't think honesty should be a problem amongst the truth brethren. That should be something that we should all be striving for continually. Apparently, this marriage counselor found that these were the big culprits of dysfunctional marriages. In a few minutes, we'll take a brief look at each of these to see if we need to work on any of these things in our marriages. But before we do that, we'd like to offer the analogy of what some call the love bank. I like the idea of the love bank. It really helps to put things kind of in a perspective. So please, give me that liberty to share this with you. The way I understand it, the love bank is an emotional banking system in a marriage where you need to make many love units, maybe love unit deposits, you might say. Love unit deposits are like telling your spouse that you love them, giving them a hug or a compliment about something that they do. Every time you extend these very positive gestures of affection or courtesy, you may deposit so many love units into your spouse's love bank. On the other hand, when you make selfish demands, when you give angry outbursts or demonstrate a lack of empathy for your spouse, you consequently make withdrawals from that same love account. Clearly, the object would be to make many and regular deposits into the love bank to secure your emotional relationship from going into insufficient funds. Overdraft charges can sometimes be pretty steep and very painful if they keep accumulating. So let's say that we have a love bank account that builds with someone. When we first meet our spouse, there may have been physical attraction there, but then enough positive deposits were made in your interactions with each other to help build it into, I really like you a lot, you know. And so from a zero balance, say up to a $1,000 balance, you have this relationship that's building. And then once you hit a deposit, say at $1,000, you cross what we might call the threshold, okay? So you cross that threshold and you just knew you were in love. Between $1 and a balance and a $1,000 balance, you really like them, but when you hit a $1,000 threshold, you knew it was love. Some marriages today, even here, have over $10,000 in their love accounts. Some of you are millionaires. And unfortunately, others, possibly here today, may have even dropped below the $1,000 threshold. because too many withdrawals were made and not enough love units were entered. It's even worse when someone drops below the zero balance and now there are simply overdraft charges on their account. Deposits are needed immediately. However, the good thing is this. Most everybody has the ability to start making more deposits into their love bank accounts and either get themselves out of the red or, better yet, turn to exceed the threshold mark of true love at the $1,000 mark. Now let's discuss some of these common love buster withdrawals. Let's talk about lack of empathy. Why in the world would any of us ever want to hurt the one that we promised to love and to cherish? We must stay emotionally connected to our mates. We must slip out of our own shoes from time to time and then slip into our spouse's. Try to really understand where they are coming from and what they are feeling. Lack of this empathy can lead to thoughtlessness. And thoughtlessness can take small as well as large withdrawals from our love bank accounts. And which of us are totally exempt from this problem? I know I'm not. On the other hand, being considerate and thoughtful to your spouse is not only respectful, it deposits love units over and over again to lead to a very healthy bank account. Now, selfish demands are expensive love buster withdrawals. We live in a kind of a me generation where it seems everything is about you and your needs being met. I perceive that marriage in most cases today, from my perspective, are kind of a 50-50 relationship of doing things for each other. Some of the best marriages I've seen are where it's a 90-10 proposition. At least it appears to be. And each partner is almost trying to outdo the other party in unselfish giving and sacrificing for each other. Fallen human selfishness is so inherent within us that we must continually fight its negative and hurtful consequences. When we make a request for something that we need or want, and our spouse isn't very cooperative, we sometimes tend to go to the next step and demand what we want. People who don't care about how others feel and only think of their own needs usually are demanding people. Demanding people don't often realize that they're being demanding and how many withdrawals they are making until they're overdrawn. Sometimes, along with the demand, comes the underlying threat that if you don't give me what I want, you'll regret it. I'll make you regret it. I'll see you suffer for it in some way. Now, we don't like to think that, but sometimes human nature comes back that way. Honey, you don't want to do it that way? Okay, I'll show you, you know. Threats are only good if there's power to back them up. And often power plays in a marriage result, and they progress until one or the other surrenders. Resentment is often a sizable love unit withdrawal from these kind of power plays. The spouse who feels resentment is less likely to meet that need in the future. As far as power plays, again, we fight our culture's disintegrating appreciation for God's guidelines. There should be a mutual respect for honest needs and wants of a person's spouse, whether it's the husband or the wife. However, tell me, which arrangement in business or government or a ship at sea works best when there are two presidents or two sea captains? The final decision has to be made by someone, and the ultimate responsibility has to stop with them. Although the man in the house should never be a tyrant, forcing his demands on a subservient wife, but should rather love his wife as Christ would love the church, his bride, we see in Ephesians 5:23 that the husband is the head of the wife, just like Christ is the head of the church. For Christian couples that really want to follow the Lord's way and not the world's way, the scriptures clearly teach this. As we read, in Ephesians 5. And we're going to read it again to emphasize just this one point, because it's a little different point than we read earlier. It says in chapter 5, 22, "Wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives." He's saying, don't be tyrants. Love your wives. And these are very important two words. Love your wives just as Christ also loved the church. There's your goal, husbands. "And gave himself for her, so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word." In 1 Corinthians 11:3 also, it clearly states who God made captain to the ship of marriage. It says, "But I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man, and the man is the head of a woman, and God is the head of Christ." This is God's arrangement, not Brother Larry's. These are from the scriptural fact pocket. If you believe and adhere to the Bible's teachings. So as far as power plays, let us be careful to not only follow the Lord's classification system, but likewise the principle and spirit of how very much Christ loves and truly is considerate of the needs of his church, his bride. Let me repeat that once again. The importance of a true man of God, making sure to listen and to consider the feelings, the thoughts, and the helpful suggestions of his beloved wife. Now, to continue with another common love buster withdrawal. Making disrespectful judgments. A disrespectful judgment, the way I understand it, is simply a refined way of getting what one spouse wishes from the other. It's where we make withdrawals by imposing our view, which we know is the superior view, of course, on the way. It's my way or the highway, right? These are disrespectful judgments because they're often associated with comments like, "If you had any sense, you'd see it my way." The other party will usually take this as personally threatening or at least rude, a rude, presumptuous attitude. Is my spouse inferring I don't have any sense? Disrespectful judgment withdrawals sometimes come in these forms. One, you have a tendency of always wanting to lecture instead of desiring to respectfully discuss the issues with your spouse. Or two, you find yourself saying, "I'd like to straighten you out on that matter." Three, you find yourself repeatedly interrupting your spouse when it's their turn to speak, preventing them from having a chance to explain their position. Four, you tend to ridicule the point of view of your spouse. Five, you often come across as having a superior point of view and never budge from your position. You're always right. Any or all of these and more can be sizable withdrawals from your love bank accounts. A true Christian spouse should be very careful not to come across in a controlling and manipulative manner to a partner in the marriage relationship. Is there room for any of us here to make any improvements? All marriages are like two friends in Proverbs, where it says that iron sharpeneth iron. There are naturally going to be disagreements on these issues, on various issues. But you can respectfully disagree with your spouse. Present your information fairly on the issue and then listen carefully and try to understand the opinion and information that your spouse shares with you. And try to be aware of fairly equal time shares of discussion. Perhaps giving a comment like, "You've made some good points for me to consider," or, "I appreciate your thoughts. Give me some time to think about that, okay?" Angry outbursts at your spouse generally come from the instinctive reaction of unfulfilled expectations of what we want. If the desires of what we want are not met and we've made selfish demands and given them disrespectful judgments, sometimes we fall into the trap of making an angry outburst. But usually, He that flies off the handle seldom makes a good landing, right? We gain nothing from the anger, for punishment from harsh words does not solve marital problems. It only makes major withdrawals from the love bank. When you become angry with your spouse, you threaten your spouse's safety and security, and you fail to provide them with protection. Your spouse will react and possibly retaliate in some hurtful way or for self-preservation. But you both lose. That's the thing. When anger wins, love will lose. The best thing to do if you have these tendencies is to kind of short-circuit your habit of losing your temper. Create new habits that will override the angry outburst tendencies. Perhaps walking away from a frustrating situation can sometimes help, or follow a routine that will relax your muscles and lower your adrenaline in your system. Whatever the conscious effort is to short-circuit your angry outbursts, do it for the Lord. Do it for your spouse, who you promised that you would love and care for. New or reshaped habits are essential for maintaining and growing a loving relationship. Another love buster is termed annoying habits. Now, I know none of us have any of those in this audience. Annoying habits can seem to drive a person crazy, sometimes in the marriage relationship. They seem like such a small thing to the person who's doing it, while their spouse seems to make it a federal case. But a repeated annoying habit, such as the way you eat or clean up after yourself, is usually done without much thought. Whenever you continue annoying habits that your spouse has kindly made you aware of, you are withdrawing love units. You can kindly mention an annoying habit in a manner in which you would want your spouse to tell you, but then drop the subject until you are both ready to deal more effectively with that topic. You may wish to develop an agreed-upon or organized plan to eliminate whatever it is. However, none of us really likes criticism, do we? So, if you're going to be pointing out annoying habits, make sure you are both prepared in your hearts with the Spirit of Christ to do something about it. After all, if you knew that something you were doing was really bothering your spouse, why would you want to continue? If you truly love your wife and respect the principles of a holy marriage, don't let annoying habits like a dripping faucet nickel and dime your love bank account until it's dry. Now let's take a look at love deposits, or what we might like to term love tokens, in a marriage relationship. Love tokens. In most every case, a man or woman marry because they are in love. And they are in love because their love bank balances are above the romantic threshold. If you want your emotions to support your marriage, you must keep your love bank accounts over the threshold line, the love threshold line. Some of the ways you can do this might be the following. Here are 12 or more love tokens for you to consider. Number one, show your admiration and your respect for your spouse as much as possible. Two, give the important ingredient of affection to your spouse by telling them that you love them, and tell them it often, by giving them a warm embrace or holding their hand. Affection is an essential cement in a marriage with longevity. Show your spouse you love them by more effectively managing your time so that you can spend more time with them. Time is a valuable commodity in today's marketplace, as we said. Don't ever underestimate its value, for marriage becomes a first mortgage on our time. Let me repeat that. Marriage becomes a first mortgage on our time. Fourth, a simple greeting card that says, I love you. In fact, I got one today. It said something like, it was a card my wife gave me and said, let's see if I remember said now, I'm going to be in trouble. It said, you're the love of my life. My world is in your heart. I thought it was very precious. But you can give greeting cards, a lot of them that say I love you. A bouquet of flowers or a tasteful gift can be make valuable love units in your love bank account. Taking a walk after dinner together or giving a nice back rub often adds more to your account. You know, the physical touch of the human hand almost has healing powers of warmth and affection. You know, sometimes just a hand on the back just does something special, you know. Giving a courtesy call about where you are and when you'll be home. This is the one I've got to work on. As well as just a phone call with loving thoughts and expressions to your spouse. Seventh, be forgiving and merciful with the shortcomings of your spouse. Indeed, bind mercy about your neck and see the pennant of love glow over the reciprocating heart. Now, politeness is very important also. I believe politeness can add a lot of love units as well. Opening a door for your spouse, saying please and thank you and excuse me, can often add many love unit deposits over time. Ninth, display of honest efforts at constructive improvements in the spouse's character or habits can also add substantial deposits, like making a real effort at picking up your dishes or perhaps waiting till your husband or wife comes in the door and has a few minutes before you start on them with all the problems, you know, of the bank account balance or whatever it may be, you know, in a financial sense. Tenth, spiritual efforts to develop in Christ-likeness and the Christian graces and fruits of the Spirit add even more units of love and admiration in the Christian marriage love of bank account. 11th, willingness to take ownership for mistakes. I think those are respected in a spouse. And honestly apologize for misgivings. Again, add to your account balance. 12th, and it doesn't hurt to be long on compliments and short on criticisms. Long on compliments and short on criticisms. Balanced compliments are important to reinforce your observations of positive actions in your spouse that you admire and that you respect. Compliments kind of reassure the spouse's perception of your love and appreciation for them. Now, brethren, we pray these thoughts have been practical, helpful suggestions for you, many of you that are married and perhaps even considering marriage, and desirous of making improvements in your relationships. You know, even if you just found one or two things that you could do to make a positive change this next year, it would make all this presentation seem worthwhile. Our last area is divorce in marriage. It's a more sensitive one. Although all the whole talk is really sensitive for that matter. I can see from the time, I guess, that we've just about run out of time. However, many married couples in the world today also feel the same way. But even though many marriages dissolve in the world around us and then remarry another partner and the world thinks nothing about it, should it be that way with us, dear friends? Do we live by God's rules or the relative rules of fallen humanity? The way I see it, I have only two options in my marriage. Make it work and love my wife in spite of our weaknesses and imperfections, or if my love bank overdrafted and insufficient funds enough, and my wife left me or became too unbearable to live together anymore. And it does happen, doesn't it? It happened with our dear pastor from the standpoint of not being able to live together, and they had to separate, right? But these are extreme cases. I would have to choose, in my case, if I had to choose separation under this, I would never divorce my wife and remarry. I would live alone for the rest of my life. Why? Because I follow the scriptural commandments on the issue of marriage. And I'm obligated to them according to the vows of my consecration. The scriptures are clear. They are not just an ideal. Jesus said, if you love me, what? Keep my commandments. So let's make sure we understand what our master said. And please understand, our purpose is not to make anybody feel uncomfortable, but rather educate the brethren to Jesus' direction on the matter. If you look at Matthew 19:9, Matthew 19:9, Jesus gives us a rule. He says, "And I say unto you, whoever divorces his wife, except for immorality, and marries another woman, commits adultery." Now, some brethren can try to twist that scripture around, in my opinion, but because they're, you know, the Jewish rabbis and so forth, they made things kind of favorable in their, side of the court, so to speak. And there was something about a bill of divorcement, and so they asked him about this bill of divorcement situation. And Jesus replied, he said, "Moses, because of the hardness of your heart, suffered you to put away your wives. But," and this is the important point, "but from the beginning it was not so." That's not the way the Lord made it. That's what he's saying. And then he says, "And I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. And whosoever marrieth her which is put away, doth commit adultery." So how many exceptions did Jesus give us to remarriage? One. And again, we find ourselves in 1 Corinthians 7, verses 10 to 11. 1 Corinthians 7:10. "But to the married I give instructions, not I, but the Lord." This is not advice now, he's saying, "but the Lord, that the wife should not leave her husband." Verse 11. "But if she does leave, she must remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband, and that the husband should not divorce his wife." This seems pretty clear to me. Under the terms and conditions of my consecration to the Lord and the rules and commandments that I've been given in His holy word, I am not at liberty to remarry unless my spouse either dies or is sexually unfaithful. 1 Corinthians 7:39. "The wife is bound as long as her husband lives, but if her husband is dead, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord." Marriage is a pledge. It's a pledge. It's a promise to God of lasting endurance. With so many marriages breaking apart in the world today, think about this. How can we glorify the Heavenly Father in our marriages? And even when our marriages are more or less challenging, and many of those that we see in the world today are like those, if they are, but yet, you know, we have some of those same problems in our marriages sometimes, but yet we stay together, we don't split up, we make it work as much as lieth within us. If not for the one we promised and gave a commitment to, then at least make it work for the praise and honor of our glorious Father. Won't these more challenged Bible student marriages that have stormed the seas, the stormy heavy seas, so to speak, in life's affairs, and yet kept their ships afloat despite the crashing waves around them, be a testimony to the praise of God's Spirit and His institution of marriage in the kingdom ages ahead? No, brother and I think marriage really isn't a checkup from the neck up, but rather it's a checkup from the heart up. Our prayer is that your hearts and your marriages in this coming year ahead might be helped, and you might find room for improvement, and with prayerful consideration upon these words, have a blessed marriage. And we thank you for your kind attention, and may the Lord add His blessing.